Just in time for Reformation Day, Concordia Publishing House has a new graphic novel titled Luther, Echoes of the Hammer. This Luther biography is written and illustrated in a fun, comfortable format. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. Or you can purchase Luther, Echoes of the Hammer by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. This new Reformation resource costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. Luther, Echoes of the Hammer, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October.
No matter what we choose to believe, there's no God who condones taking the life of an innocent human being.
Where I think we are in the culture, but also with religious institutions, is that people have stopped hating us, that is to say LGBT people, but they're not yet ready to celebrate us. That's the next big work to do.
Maybe it's something as simple as you whistle while you work.
Just whistle while you work.
Mega churches are a house of cards. Mega churches really are the primary example of what's wrong with evangelicalism, why it's so thin, so insubstantial, so unsatisfying.
Southern Illinois truck drivers, love issues, etc.
We began our series on the Great Schism of 1054 with Dr. Matt Phillips, pointing out that the schism didn't really actually happen or break suddenly, as things do, in 1054. It was a long time coming, a really long time coming for theological, geographical, political, and personal reasons. But by 1054, we have what historians regard as a great split in the Christian church, East and West. What really happened in 1054? Was it really as clean a split? Was it a final split, as historians have kind of said it is in their thumbnail sketch, never to be mended again? Were there attempts early on to mend the schism of 1054? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. on this Friday afternoon, October the 14th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Dr. Matt Phillips joins us for part two of a four-part weekly series on the Great Schism. Today, what really happened in 1054? After that, we're going to be talking with Dr. Andrew Steinman, continuing our series with him on biblical chronology, part four of a six-part series on biblical chronology, today dealing with the crux of all human history, the birth of Christ, which, by the way, didn't happen in zero AD or BC. It happened a little bit off the calendar that we count. There are reasons for that, but we can know with very accurate certainty what year Jesus was born, and that helps us understand a lot of the other history surrounding there. We'll sort through all those problems in the second half hour of Issues Etc. on this Friday afternoon, October the 14th. Dr. Matt Phillips is Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. Matt, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be back.
Do a brief review for us, if you would, of the years, or really the centuries, leading up to the Schism of 1054, the major factors that played into that year being the date recognized by historians as the Great Split.
So the major theological factor that had come to the front in the 8th and 9th centuries was the Filioque that we talked about last time, the debate over whether the phrase "and the Son" should be added to the whole "from whom the Holy Spirit proceeds." The East said no, and the West said yes. In 1014, approximately around then, a papal-led council in the West, officially, if you want to call it that way, said, yes, it should be in there. So that was a big theological issue. There are also political issues. You have people in the West now calling themselves emperor. You had Charlemagne, but his line kind of died out, and then a new restoration of the empire really centered more in the German-speaking lands under Otto the First and his successors, and they claimed the imperial title. The popes gave them essentially the imperial title, and that caused some political split. Although some of the people in Otto's dynasty, some of the emperors did marry into the Byzantines, so there was some making up along those lines politically. So there was interchange continually. The Byzantine Empire, which is where the Orthodox Church was mostly centered, did still have territory in southern Italy. So there was still diplomatic exchanges. There were still Greek right churches and monasteries in the West, in Italy, and there were also some Latin Rite churches in Constantinople that were connected to the Pope. So there had been a Photian schism in the late 9th century. They had kind of kissed and made up, I guess, about that. They didn't really solve the Filioque issue, but they did make up. So that's kind of where we are going into the 11th century.
All right. So in 1054, what actually occurred?
Well, you had a kind of the rise of a new type of papacy in the mid-11th century. It generally, most historians call it the Gregorian Reform Movement or the Papal Reform Movement. And this papacy began to assert its authority more definitively in the West, particularly. And when you think of the medieval papacy, this is kind of where it begins. One of the delegates that was sent by the Pope at the time, Leo the Ninth, went to deal with a controversy that had developed. The theological controversy was quite interesting over whether leavened or unleavened bread should be used in the Lord's Supper. And the West tended to use unleavened bread, and the East, the patriarch in Constantinople, began to make a big deal out of this, saying that they were to basically, we should use, in the East, they said we should use leavened bread because that would separate us from the Jews more, basically. And the patriarch began to make a big deal out of this. His name was Michael Severlarius. So the papal legate Humbert and some others were sent to deal about this issue. And basically, they said, he's the Pope. He has the authority. You should submit to his authority. That's basically what they said to the patriarch. He really just kind of ignored them. So they got kind of mad, wrote up a document of excommunication, during the Divine Liturgy and placed it on the altar and walked out. So that is generally the history moment, in, you know, if you're taking a class, when you say this is the moment when the schism happened in 1054, and then he excommunicated them, and that's when the, quote, schism happened at that moment.
Did this papal delegation visiting Constantinople, had they been authorized by the Pope to excommunicate, to issue this excommunication?
That's a good question. It was kind of interesting. He did send this fellow Humbert, who was a cardinal bishop by that time. He had actually been a monk who had come in with the other papal reform group. And he was kind of a hothead, you might say, or maybe a really ardent, maybe a better way to say, ardent papal reformer. And actually, by the time the bull of excommunication was written up and given to the patriarch of Constantinople, the Pope had actually died, which would have rendered their papal... They were papal legates, basically papal ambassadors. But since that pope had died, by the time they had done this, it would have rendered their authority null and void, right? Because they would have had to been reissued authority by the next pope, and they had not been. So that's one big question that people will point out when they discuss this. The other question is, who were they excommunicating? They did not see, most people would say, they did not see excommunicating one patriarch, and that was their position, means they're excommunicating the whole Greek-speaking or Eastern Church as we would see it today. They were saying, we're excommunicating this patriarch for his actions. And on the other side, the Greeks could say, the patriarch could say, I was excommunicating those legates for their actions. You know, so it is not as clear-cut as, you know, you have the basically textbook, this is when the Great Schism happened, and we haven't been restored since. If you're a person at that time who was actually following it, it wouldn't have been as clear-cut to you. And there are a lot of other political issues that get involved, as in most things.
From what we know of Leo the Ninth, who was the pope that sent the delegation and then died before the actual excommunication was placed on the altar, from what we know of him, would he have attempted to essentially depose the Patriarch of Constantinople if that patriarch did not, submit to his authority on this issue of leaven or unleavened bread?
That's a good question. I'm not sure he wouldn't have done that. It's not like popes had hesitated to do such a thing before this time. In fact, in the old Devotian schism that happened in the late 9th century, that's why it happened. A pope named Nicholas, I think it was Nicholas I, actually basically did the same thing. He sought to depose the person who was a patriarch who had, in his mind, wrongly taken the office. So it wasn't that there wasn't precedent for this in the Western papacy's mind. So I don't think it would have. I think he might have done it. I don't know if he might have negotiated longer, maybe. Maybe he'd have been more diplomatic before he did that.
Okay.
Maybe that's a better way to say it.
I guess another question that I have is, was this, and I know it's an impossible question really to ask in terms of rock-solid history, was this inevitable? Was this just an accident waiting to happen, and this just so happened to be the flashpoint at which it occurred? Or was, in other words, was the relationship already so far gone that a schism of some kind was inevitable?
Well, it's a good question. I get, you know, looking back in hindsight, I guess we could say it was. I wouldn't say inevitable, but we could say obviously that there were enough religious divisions with the Filioque. But it's interesting. Initially, with the Filioque, it doesn't even come up a lot at this schism, which is still the main one of the main theological issues, right? It really starts over this thing that a lot of us might find kind of odd about this whole dispute over leaven or unleavened bread and which one should be used. But there was another political issue I want to mention. The papacy had recently, in the early 1050s, made a political ally with these Norman knight adventurers who were conquering parts of Italy. And they were actually fighting Byzantine-supported nobles in southern Italy, and the papacy kind of gave them their permission, essentially, and so this caused further political rift between the two sides.
Let's take a break. I want to come back to that particular political aspect of this, and then as our conversation continues with Professor Matt Phillips on the 1054 split of the church, we're doing a series with him. This is part two of a four-part weekly series. I'm interested in knowing whether or not this split was at least in and around the time it occurred, considered to be a schism, considered to be a real split between East and West, or just another tiff. We'll be right back.
How would you like to win the Essential Lutheran Library? Books like Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions, Law and Gospel, the Lutheran Service Book, and the Lutheran Book of Prayer, and four more resources. All you have to do is share the Issues Etc. Reformation Week video on your Facebook page and send an email to contest@issuesetc.org. You'll find the video at issuesetc.org and click support. We'll announce the winner of the Essential Lutheran Library on Friday, October 28th.
Issues Etc. is listener supported. That means we rely on you for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support.
Luther had Wartburg. We have Collinsville. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Y'all been hearing about Country Bob's all-purpose sauce and how it tastes great on any and everything you may be cooking and serving at your family dinner table. Well, over the years, I've discovered that Country Bob's is much more than that. You see, Country Bob's is that secret ingredient in many of my recipes, whether it be for chili soups or stews or that favorite marinade for the select meat of the day we're grilling. If you're interested in discovering the secret, log on to countrybobs.com and check out their blog, exchange recipes, or buy yourself a Country Bob's cookbook and become part of the Country Bob's family. And remember, it all comes down to the sauce.
At steadfastlutherans.org, we've been called contentious. We've even been called the brothers of John the curmudgeon, and we may well be curmudgeonly sometimes. But we always have the best and clearest voices in confessional Lutheranism. Articles from Molly Hemingway, Martin Nolan, Clement Preuss, Todd Wilkin, and a host of regular contributors. Come check out the new Lutheran media. Always clear, always concise, always confessionally Lutheran. SteadfastLutherans.org.
Welcome back. This is Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Matt Phillips is our guest, Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. We're talking about the Great Schism of 1054, part two of a four-part weekly series on the history, the politics, the theology surrounding the Great Schism. You mentioned before the break, and I want to give you adequate time to explain, this group of Norman knight conquerors that the Pope had given authority. What were they doing there? I mean, this is prior to, or this is certainly not connected with the Crusades per se. What were they conquering?
Well, basically, they were stealing Byzantine territory in southern Italy, which to the Byzantines, remember, they still, up to this time, consider themselves the Roman Empire. Okay, Byzantine is what we call them as historians, but they called themselves Romans, and they saw, to them, that was part of their empire, and they held it, and they still claimed a lot of other territory, which they really didn't hold, but... And this is another reason why connection with Rome remained for such a long time, too, and why it was a big deal dealing with the papacy. So when the papacy basically gave these papal reformers their religious permission to these Norman adventurer knights in southern Italy, it really caused a rift with the empire, the Byzantine Empire, and the emperor and the patriarch are usually very closely connected. The patriarchs were usually appointed by the Byzantine emperor, so there was a lot of political intrigue there that was very significant. So this was a part of the rift that led to, basically, with the controversy over the Azzanine controversy, it's called, over the bread, led to each other shutting down each other's rights. So the Greek churches were shut down in Rome, and then they're using Greek rites, and then vice versa happened in Constantinople. And then you had these political fights going on in southern Italy, so it caused a lot of division in those two.
So was it also a liturgical thing? I mean, given the fact that we are talking about two different rites, when you see R-I-T-E, rites in the church, was, I mean, other than the language, one was predominantly Latin, one was Greek. Other than the language, were the rites substantially different from one another?
That is a good question. I mean, I've studied more of the Western liturgy myself. I think there were significant differences, but I don't think that bothered anybody a whole lot. The main difference theologically there was, the main difference theologically was the filioque, although that didn't really come up much, interestingly enough, with this great schism, in 1054 anyway. The filioque really didn't come up much at all. That comes up later in all the polemical writings and so forth, but I don't think it was much the huge liturgical differences. It wasn't a worship war in that sense, but it was more of the one issue over the bread that for whatever reason became a main issue. And then it really came down to, and I think this is what ultimately leads to the definitive split that we could really trace over the next 100 years or so, theologically and ecclesiastically, is what's the authority of the papacy? That's really what it comes down to. And I think today even, the Orthodox churches, there are different communions of the Orthodox churches, and the Roman Catholic Church, I mean, they agree on the same number of sacraments. They have a lot of similarities. Obviously, there's going to be differences. The big issue really is, what is the authority of the Pope, and what authority does the Bishop of Rome have? And I just don't ever see those churches accepting what the Pope still claims.
I mean, what you're saying is that for the schism to be mended.
Right. I'm talking about today, right.
Okay, so in other words, Rome is so associated with the authority of the papal office, and the East will never accept that. This is not something
that develops. What I'm saying is that develops more after 1054. By say, from 1054 to, let's say, 1200, 150-year period, by 1200, you have Innocent III, who is the Pope extraordinaire of the Middle Ages, and he claims... He is the epitome of the medieval monarchical pope. He claims to be the king of the church, essentially. Of course, the servant of the servants of Christ, as the vicar of Christ on earth. And so, the papal claims become more specific and more ardent, and over the 12th century. And I think that helps lead to further division between the churches. And some other important political events we'll probably talk about next time, I think.
How permanent was the schism viewed in the decades after the excommunications? Were there attempts to patch things up?
Yeah, it really wasn't viewed permanently at all by a lot of people. Both sides, I think I kind of mentioned before, was these excommunications really should have ended with these people's deaths. It wasn't a permanent split with a group. It was a excommunication of individuals on both sides. But, you know, all the things we've talked about, the theological issues, the linguistic, cultural issues, and all that did continue to this divide. There were attempts, especially with the advent of the Crusades, because the Crusades, one of the motivations for the Western Crusades initially was to help bring about unity again between the East and the West. And one of the, Urban II, who's the Pope who caused the Crusade in the 1090s, explicitly says, we're going to the East to fight with our Christian brothers to defend Christianity from the Muslims who are attacking them. And he makes a big deal out of, Urban does even before that, of explicitly doing away, he explicitly states many times, well, we're going to mend this fence, we don't recognize all these splits that happened in the past. So they seem to be formally reunited by the beginning of the First Crusade. A lot of people would argue that. Some others might argue differently, but they're in 1096, with the First Crusade happening, they're fighting on the same side, apparently. They're saying they like each other, you know. Now, it'll be, ironically, the Crusades, I think, that help bring about the definitive split, interestingly enough. So,
Are you saying that, at least with regard to Pope Urban,
right,
he hoped that the Crusades would be a unifying factor for
absolutely,
the Church?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, his predecessor, who's known as the first great papal reformer, Gregory VII, he was part of the what's known as the investiture controversy in the West with the emperor, with the German emperor. But he actually had a plan to lead what would have been probably the first crusade in the 1070s. And he had written to the emperor, because the Byzantines had just lost a major battle to the Turks. He had written to him and said, I want to lead an army to come help you, my Christian brothers, and this will help. So, yes, the Reformed papacy, which eventually brought about the preaching of the Crusades and the event known as the Crusades, part of their goal was to help bring about the unity, reunify the Church. And at first they were very accommodating and very specific in their desire to bring about open unity.
So how is it, as you just said, that what began as, in part, an attempt to fight alongside and unify the Church became, as you just said, the definitive break? How did the Crusades lead to that definitive break?
Well, we did a series on the Crusades, so the First Crusade ends, let's say, around 1100, and the events that end the First Crusade up to the Fourth Crusade in 1204, so let's say about a 100-year period, by 1204, you have a crusade that actually does what? It sacks Constantinople. And it's kind of complicated, but basically it sacks Constantinople. It got way off course, but that event is what most people would say brings about the definitive break. They sacked Constantinople, and they put a Latin patriarch. So they bring a guy from the West and make him patriarch of Constantinople, and this is just never accepted by anybody in the East. And so, that really leads to the real split, I think. The definitive split would be a better way to say it.
So what had began centuries before and kind of been bubbling to the surface was manifested in this sudden mutual excommunication in 1054 that might have ended with the lives of those who had excommunicated
right.
one another. But by the time we get to 1200 or so,
yes.
we have the West sacking the capital city of the East, and now we can say this is real schism.
Yes, and again, there are we can look at points in between them. Even with the end of the First Crusade, with the establishment of what became known as the Crusader States, which are kind of led by some of the leaders that survived the First Crusade, originally they had told the emperor that they would give him all the territory back. But because of the issues that happened during the Crusade, they decided they weren't going to do that. Well, they accused him of going back on his word, and of course, you know, he disagreed. And so you have the establishment of these Crusader States, which are in territory that was supposed to be given back to the Byzantine emperor. So throughout the next 100-year period, sometimes they're allies, sometimes the Byzantines allied with different Turkish groups against Crusader States. So It's not an easy. It gets very complicated with politics sometimes. It makes strange bedfellows, as they say.
With only about 20 seconds here, next time we're going to be talking with you about the later medieval attempts to reconcile the Eastern and Western Church. What's on tap with about 20 seconds?
I think we should probably pick up there with what happens with the Latin Patriarch after the Fourth Crusade, which actually lasts until 1261. So there is a Latin Patriarchate. There are attempts then in the late 1200s, and there's a couple of different councils that occur. Of course, with the Byzantine Empire shrinking, the Ottoman Turks rise to power, and they're looking for an ally in the West to help them. So there's a Council of Florence is probably the main one. So we'll talk about some of those main councils and what happened.
Dr. Matt Phillips is Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. Thank you very much for being our guest. Look forward to next time.
Me too. Thank you.
Let's see. When we come back from this break, we're going to round off today's Issues, Etc. on this Friday afternoon, October the 14th, picking up part four of a six-part series on biblical chronology with Dr. Andrew Steinman, author of the book From Abraham to Paul, A Biblical Chronology. We'll talk about the birth of Christ. Monday on Issues, Etc., you want to tune in to this. If you can't live, then catch it on demand. A five-part daily series with the late Dr. Kenneth Corby, a true Issues, Etc. classic, on confession and absolution. That starts Monday on Issues, Etc. We'll be right back. Talk to Dr. Andrew Steinman about the birth of Christ and its date.
Ah, the sounds of rich liturgy and historic Christian worship. What a way to spend a Sunday morning. At Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt, Illinois, you'll find authentic Christianity as you hear the preaching of Christ crucified for the forgiveness of your sins. Come, join us Sunday mornings at 9 and Monday evenings at 7:30, and find out more about Trinity Lutheran Church, Millstadt, Illinois, at trinitymillstadt.org.
Here's an opportunity for you to get up to 75% off many of the resources you hear us promote on Issues, Etc. It's Concordia Publishing House's warehouse sale from 8 in the morning until noon on Saturday, November 5th. Concordia Publishing House is located south of Interstate 44 at 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis. The 2011 warehouse sale, Saturday morning, November the 5th at Concordia Publishing House, 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Researchers find voluntary assisted suicide in Belgium isn't always voluntary.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Recent findings published in the Canadian Medical Journal reveal over 100 nurses in Belgium admitted to helping euthanize patients without their consent. The journal observed many nurses likely underreported their involvement for fear of prosecution. According to the law, only doctors may euthanize a patient. Dr. Peter Saunders, director of Care Not Killing in Britain, observes, "We should take a warning from this that wherever you draw the line, people will go up to it and beyond. Once you've legalized voluntary euthanasia, involuntary euthanasia will inevitably follow."
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.